Hello and welcome to Inside Whitehall with me, Jonathan Gullis. Sadly, James, my co-host, is unable to be with us today, but he will be returning to the pod soon, I assure you. But we're delighted still to carry on to make sure that we don't miss this amazing opportunity to sit down with a very important individual in Whitehall. We are with Gareth Davies, MP for Grantham and Stamford, who is also the Exchequer Secretary in the Treasury. And of course, we've just had recently a big fiscal event, the budget, and we're going to be exploring that more in detail. But before we get into that, what I want to do is start off with a little bit about who Gareth is. So Gareth, a man who grew up in Leeds, who's done a very good job of hiding that accent, I think, before attending both Nottingham and Harvard universities, spent 14 years of experience in the financial sector before being elected in 2019 alongside myself to the Grantham and Stamford constituency, a constituency that is famous because it was the home of constituency of a certain Margaret Thatcher. Obviously, this is in rural constituency as well, so a lot of ground to cover. And I think he's had a bit of playing around with the boundaries as well. So Gareth has been learning new bits that he's about to inherit in the upcoming election too. In April 2023, Gareth was brought in to the Exchequer Secretary of the Treasury and is going to give us that insight in the build-up and the aftermath of a spring budget. Gareth, welcome to the pod.
Great pleasure, Jonathan, to be with you.
Now, we always start off by asking people what got them into politics, why go on this journey, how long that journey was, the highs and the lows. Mm. Give us the story. Why did you want to enter Whitehall?
I think, like a lot of our colleagues, you know, you have this inherent interest in politics as a kid. And that is forged by your experiences. And usually, in my case, certainly by my parents. So growing up, you know, listening to my dad, who ran a small business, my mum as a primary school teacher, their concerns, and also the circumstances of the time. Like you, I grew up under, you know, New Labour, effectively, and all that came with that. And so, you know, I was very acutely aware growing up that I wanted to be in the arena, as they say, and play a part in it, but was very conscious as well that I wanted to do something beforehand. And that's why I went into business and went into the financial services sector for quite a long time. And I've been well served by that, just like a lot of our colleagues have been served well by their careers. In your case, being a teacher, you can just add so much more to debates. And in this case, you know, being in the Treasury, as somebody that used to work in not just business, but the financial services sector, you know, you're not essentially starting from scratch. You are a round peg in a round hole. And I think that's something in government we need to do a bit more of, frankly.
Now, you've also in your time had a young child like myself. How is it trying to balance that family life and bringing up a child? You've got a very lovely partner who I know is incredibly patient, just like my own, but also doing a job as serious as big as this, bearing in mind, obviously, inheriting a very difficult financial situation, not just in the country, but obviously across the world as well.
It's a real balancing act. And by the way, we've doubled the size of our
of course.
Children number.
You're fully copying me now.
So George has arrived 8 months ago. And so, it's a balancing act. And but I wouldn't change it for the world. You just have to make sure that you manage your time effectively and that you're focused on the job here at the Treasury. You're focused on your job as a member of parliament, but that you have enough time to really focus on what matters most, quite frankly, which is our family and our kids. Because actually, that ultimately is another reason why we're doing this job, because we want to leave for their generation a better country than we walked into when we came into Parliament. And that's what drives me every day.
Now, the Harvard University thing I found interesting because it was an award, was it not, or a scheme that you sort of won in order to go there. How did you end up stateside? And I think you worked over there as well in the financial services, as well as in the United Kingdom as well.
Yeah, so that's right. You really are well
we
researched,
dug into
aren't you?
You?
My gosh, if only your speeches were this well researched, Jonathan. Slightly scary as well. No, yes, this was a conscious decision. I think, you know, like probably you, I always had a feeling that one day I wanted to go into politics. But I had this acute sort of realization quite sort of in the middle of my finance career, I didn't know enough about certain areas of policy. And there was just no way in which I could do that full-time job, as well as sit back and really think about the things that I wanted to focus on if I did get elected, if I did go into politics one day. So I just said, you know what, I'm going to take a break. and I took a break from my career, worked for a company that were very supportive. I applied. I didn't win a competition. I literally applied, did the entrance exams to do a master's of public administration at the Kennedy School of Government, which I only applied there, by the way. I only wanted to go there at just as the school that was known in the world for being the place to study public policy. Now, we also have schools here in the UK, but I wanted that different perspective over in the United States. And so did that, met my wife, my future wife there. And that's why just shortly after graduating, I actually ended up negotiating with my employer to send me back to the US so I could hang out with my girlfriend and now my wife, and the rest is history. And in the end, managed to bring her over here to the UK with me.
Was she negotiating to stay stateside out of interest to avoid coming back? Or was
she was absolutely delighted to move to our country, especially when she realised we may win the 2019 election.
Absolutely. And Leeds is an interesting place, right? Because Leeds as a political landscape, I'm assuming throughout your childhood, would have been a very strong Labour kind of area, both in terms of local government and national government in terms of representation. What was it that drew you to the Conservatives out of interest? What was that journey for you? Is it parents naturally Tory, or is it you were on a journey yourself and sort of came across the Conservative Party?
Yeah, I think your family play a major part in forging your, you know, certainly forming your views on how the world works and your values as well. And, you know, I grew up, it sounds a bit twee, but I definitely grew up appreciating hard work and responsibility, and, you know, seeing my dad go to work every morning, come back very late after I'd gone to bed, you know, starting this business, keeping it alive, definitely inspired me to want to make sure that anybody that is willing to take the risk of setting up a business in this country has as much support as possible from the government. He felt under Labour that perhaps there could have been a lot more support, and that his natural home was the Conservative Party. And just through conversations and that experience, obviously you arrive at a political party. But I certainly wasn't born into the Conservative Party. I came to it, and I realized that this was my, you know, political home because of my values, my outlook, and my background. And it almost doesn't matter where I grew up, whether Leeds is more Labour or Conservative, yeah, or whatever. It's about your personal experience. By the way, I did try to be the MP for Leeds in 2017, but failed, sadly, to a very good man who is Hilary Benn. But I did try to represent the area that I grew up in. Sadly, it wasn't.
I ran against Sharon Hodgson in Washington and Sunday West. There we go. Finally got my words above me. And yeah, I unlike you, can't claim to have any Northeast natural links, but Sharon was exceptionally lovely and a very good person as well. And it's, you know, quite nice, I think, when you run against someone, actually, then you see them in Parliament, you get to sort of know them. And that
Absolutely.
Would have been a tough contest. So Grantham and Stamford, out of interest, obviously a lot of history in Conservative politics in that seat. What was it like when you're told you're in the final three, I'm presuming, which would be normal for Conservative associations for listeners? You normally have a long list of like 7 to 10, then they whittle that down to three, and then the entire membership get to vote on that final three. Were you acutely aware? Was there a lot of pressure because of the history of the seat in the sense of Margaret Thatcher represented it? Or actually, is that kind of like a longer distant memory? You know, it's a legacy, but doesn't have to shape whoever takes the seat on from now on.
No, I think that was acutely, we were acutely aware of as candidates going into it. And that was definitely an attractive feature for some people who perhaps hadn't even been to Grantham before. I had and have. Albeit somewhat distant family connections to Lincolnshire, and went there as a child. But I think, you know, if you're a Conservative, you know, Grantham, where this country, our party's first woman prime minister and leader, and what a leader, is from, that's a pretty attractive thing as a Conservative candidate. Certainly one of the reasons I was very keen to put myself forward for it. Incidentally, it was also quite popular because I think it was the second Conservative previously held seat to be available and to be up for selection. So a lot of candidates, not just saying it to make myself sound better, but they were, you know, I was also acutely aware I was against some very good people, and it was a tough contest. You know, as you say, it's quite a a long drawn out process of applying, you know, in written form, and then they do the sift, and then you're through to final 10. And that was on a Saturday, and, you know, you're locked in a room with other candidates. They whittle it down to four, which then is the final, a week and a half, 2 weeks, time from then. I had no idea I would progress even to the long list, which I was fortunate to do. And certainly didn't think I'd be in the shortlist, to the extent that we flew off on our honeymoon and got a call literally saying, well done, you know, it's amazing news for you. You are now going to be in the final on Wednesday. Meanwhile, I was in sunnier climes with my new wife, and had to break it to her that instead of staying at the very lovely hotel that we'd had booked for quite some time, we're going to stay at the Urban Hotel in Grantham final, and the rest is history anyway. But
well, that's a great story to end with. So that's all that personal section. Thank you, Gareth. And that just goes to show, listeners, just, you know, tenacity, never giving up, and sacrifice that not just candidates, but families themselves have to make in order to get here. Well, look, we're here to obviously talk about the budget, and kind of want to go through the journey from the beginning all the way through to sort of a post-mortem of it after you've landed it. I suppose my first question is, for listeners' sake, there's this term budget and there's another term autumn statement, and these two things get talked about each and every year. What's the difference between the two of them?
So traditionally, there are two what's called fiscal events in a year. And you know, history shows that we usually have a spring budget and an autumn statement. And typically, the budget is bigger, has more measures, anything between 100 and 200 different announcements or different changes or decisions is probably the best way of putting it. And then the autumn statement typically is a sort of shorter or smaller package of measures. But both of them historically focus on tax and spending. But in recent years, we've seen a lot more added to budgets on the supply side. So, and the same for autumn statements as well. So it's not unusual now for a chancellor to make announcements on planning reform or other measures, such as, you know, we've had a big focus on getting people back into work and boosting workforce participation through childcare reforms, for example. And so, in time, it's become more of a focus for a collection of different policies, usually with a sort of common goal and theme. You know, if you take our last three fiscal events, the focus has been about growth, growing the economy, either through workforce participation or boosting business investment, the two levers we feel are the most important for growing the economy. And so that's typically the distinction.
And we had the autumn statement normally around the sort of September, maybe October time. How quickly after that event do you start preparation for the budget, which, as you say, is typically in the March of a sort of calendar year?
So I think there's a perpetual bit of work that's going on constantly through the year where you're thinking, you know, you want to do something and you couldn't do it at the last fiscal event, so maybe you do it at the next. But a typical budget process starts about 10 to 12 weeks beforehand.
Okay.
But the reality is, you know, we don't stop working just if there's not a budget in 10 weeks' time. So there's constant work going on. By the way, there's also constant engagement as well. So whether it's on engagement to do with fuel duty or the alcohol industry, and whether what we can do for various sectors within that. These are all conversations and meetings that are feeding into the budget process for consideration when it comes to the crunch point, which is when you're actually making the decisions that's going to go to the OBR for scoring, and then make it into the final package on the day.
So we've got this process about sort of 3 months in advance of the actual announcement, so the formal process begins. Now, a budget is interesting because, of course, you've got your treasury hat on, you've got to look at how much money there is, but there's also, let's be frank, a political element to it as well. And that's certainly been talked about a lot in terms of the most recent one. So what I'm keen to understand is, what's the engagement like in this? Is it purely a treasury process which you feed into number 10, or how much is number 10 feeding into and involved themselves in this process? Bearing in mind, obviously, the Chancellor does live next door to the Prime Minister.
So the first thing to say is that I certainly, since doing this job, appreciate that how important it is for the Chancellor and the Prime Minister to work closely together and be good partners. And we certainly have that with Jeremy Hunt and Rishi Sunak. They work very closely together and very collegiately. And that's really important for the country to see that happen, just as it was for Cameron and Osborne, for example. But this is a Treasury-owned piece of work. Obviously, you know, the first Lord of the Treasury is the Prime Minister. Not always appreciated. That it says it on the letterbox, I think, of number 10.
It
right?
does indeed.
But the Chancellor is given responsibility for formulating the proposals and the policies in the budget and in the autumn statement. But of course, he works very closely with the Prime Minister as he goes along and makes those decisions. I think the thing to say about how they work together is about the principles of what we're trying to do with these fiscal events. So I've said the last three fiscal events, in our case, have been focused on growth, and whether that's workforce participation or business investment. And then working with his Treasury ministers, we all have a significant impact and contribution to make in terms of the decision, you know, literally hundreds of decisions that go into a budget. And so that's been another realization since becoming a Treasury minister, just how much it is a team effort within the Treasury, and the different ministers all have their different parts to play in that budget process.
So when we have that, you're sort of, is there like a formal meeting where all of you as ministers are brought into the Chancellor's office and you go, right, guys, the work's about to begin. What ideas have we got on the table? Or is it more of a, the Chancellor says, this is the overall aim, go away and look at things and come back. Engagement with departments as well, I'm fascinated by. So when you're doing this process, what are you doing with government departments? So is this their last chance saloon to get bids in for funding? Is it their, are you asking them where things could be potentially saved? All that kind of stuff, really. What's the first meeting like? Or is it kind of just a, right, crack on and come in with feeding ideas as and when you get them in?
Yeah, I think there's a gen, like I said, the work is always going on here. And we have a pretty good sense of, you know, kind of things that we want to do that we haven't done yet or we want to do more of. So there's no one sort of crunch meeting at all. It's something that, you know, forms of many different aspects and different activities. So like I said, the engagement process that we have is critical, right? So we meet with the Federation of Small Business, we meet with the Scottish Whisky Association, we meet with all sorts of different industry bodies and companies. The Chancellor, by the way, having been PPS to the Chancellor, this Chancellor, before I got this job, you know, he expends so much time meeting with members of Parliament. You know, he will meet with...
He's met with me quite a few times.
I'm sure he has. I'm sure he has. And...
I'm still waiting for more money, Chancellor, just in case you're tuning in.
I think he throws a few duty for you.
He does, indeed.
But look, I think, you know, that is a really important part of this process as well, because constituency MPs obviously will have their perspective and their projects or whatever it is to feed into the process as well. So it isn't like there's a crunch meeting. But the other aspect is, as you allude to, our engagement with other departments. And I guess there's two parts to this. One, we have what's called a spending review every 4 years or so, where the departmental spending amounts are decided, and it's up to department secretaries of state and ministers to formulate policy and
this is when everyone's saying they always need more, Gareth. This is when everyone's coming to Treasury going, oh, we need more, Minister. We need much more money.
I think my experience typically of departments is that they are very efficient at spending money, particularly as relates to this government. And you know, we've got a big public sector productivity drive, which will unlock more money, which means that we don't have to spend as much. But incidentally, public spending has gone up over this parliament in real terms by about 3.2%. So spending is up, but it's what you do with that money. And departments and secretary of states that we work with are typically extremely good at sort of making sure money is well spent.
I was about to say, with that additional spending that they get, is that, do you have to agree with that in advance in terms of what they're going to spend it on or prioritize, or is it quite loose? There's like a set of ideas, but it's not a rigid system of that's what we're going to do and that's what we're only spend it on.
So we have a spending review, like I said, every 4 years. There's another one after the next general election to set the budgets. And then the fiscal events, which is about tax and spending, we can make additional announcements on spending, and we do. And that is with working with departments. But to answer your question very directly, we have something called the value for money framework. We have the group, you know, the sort of green book process, which is how we analyze and assess projects and policies for funding, so that, you know, the taxpayer can be reassured that there is a robust process and oversight from not just the departments themselves, but also working together in partnership with the Treasury to make sure that every penny is well spent.
So interesting. So in the budget, we might hear, as we have heard recently, the NHS is going to receive around an extra £6 billion, but obviously sort of with different projects in mind, some digitization, some productivity driving. But essentially, the spending review is the key thing for the departments in terms of really having a clear idea of what their budget is. And then, of course, as and when maybe events occur, Treasury throughout the year, not necessarily just at the budget autumn statement, can intervene, interject, or support in any way the department find flexibility. I certainly found that. I remember when I was in, we were talking about, in the Department for Education, we were talking about the impact of rising energy costs on schools. And so I remember Jeremy at the time writing, saying, if we can't give you new money, what would be the implication for your budget? And I had to lay bare some very uncomfortable things. I certainly was very clear that I wasn't willing to personally announce nor support, and would have to have left my role in government if that had been the case. But of course, it was also a good idea for Jeremy to understand just what budgets were like, and then actually come to that negotiation of, well, if there is underspend over here, could that be used in part? But then we could also, as Jeremy did do, give it an additional money for schools in particular to cover energy bills and energy costs. So schools had their reassurance, and in part as well with wages, I think a large significant contribution towards the increase in public sector wages towards organisations as well. So that kind of, that's kind of natural process, I'm assuming, that goes as and when events occur, that you'll be talking with department heads or junior ministers or even Secretary of State on a regular basis.
There's a great partnership, like I said, between the Treasury and departments. The spending review process is to give more certainty to departments and long-term amount of money that can be spent, and then it's up to the departments to determine how best to spend that, again working with the Treasury. But you're right, events happen, right? And we've had, you know, in just our time, Jonathan, right? We've had two massive global shocks with the pandemic and then the war in Ukraine. And that has resulted in the government needing to step in with additional funds. So if you take the energy spike, you know, effectively, I think it was nearly £100 billion
yes.
of capital to, you know, in part pay 50% of people's energy bills. Or to offer business support to, you know, pubs and restaurants and other businesses that, you know, saw skyrocketing bills, which may have otherwise meant that they go out of business. So there are things that happen where you do need to step in and use taxpayer money to, you know, stabilize the economy and stabilize businesses or the public sector. And we have shown, I think, in the last few years that, while it's, you know, a naturally uncomfortable thing for a conservative government to spend lots of money, you need to when global shocks happen and when people are really suffering or businesses are really suffering. And we've done that. We've shown that we will do that, whether it is through the pandemic, spending £400 billion on things like the furlough scheme, or through Ukraine, you know, helping with energy bills. And as a result of those measures and that money that's been spent, we've seen that while the economy has clearly, you know, taken a knock like many countries, most countries around the world, it's enabled us to maintain a resilient, level of demand. We saw today inflation, you know, has gone down significantly. January had a pretty decent month for GDP. And out of the pandemic, we grew faster than most of our international peers because of the furlough scheme. So, you know, sometimes stepping in with additional money is the right thing to do in an exceptional circumstance.
And of course, one of the things we've now heard a lot of in the lead up to this budget in particular was just how much money is there available for the government to spend and invest in public services or to give towards tax cuts or a mixture of the two, of course, not mutually exclusive from one another. And I suppose that's where I'm keen, because you're in the budget process, so you've started, you're looking at ideas. You've got these organisations, listeners will hear about, they've got the IFS, the Institute for Fiscal Studies, you've got the OBR, the Office for Budget Responsibility. Then you've got groups like the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, the Resolution Foundation, all of whom, whenever they talk or make noise, end up being top bill on news channels. Now, to Joe Blogs on the Street, busy lives, they don't have necessarily all the time in the world to tune in to understand what all these different organizations are about. The Office of Budget Responsibility is an arm's length body of government that is basically checking your sums, if I understand it correct, and letting you know what they predict may or the fiscal sort of landscape is. Is that a fair assessment so far?
That's basically it. The OBR was created, I think, in 2012 to essentially conduct analysis for the government based on our fiscal rules. So we have fiscal rules, which the OBR used to provide the Chancellor with advice on how much what is called headroom is available at a particular fiscal event. And so I think they are a useful organization for not just providing forecasts as to what may happen in the future, but to provide an assessment for the Chancellor on their current state of finances. And really it's to, you know, I think it was created to act as a reassurance to the taxpayer that you've got this body that is holding the Treasury to account in a very independent way. What it is not is a policy-making body. It is purely to analyse and, you know, and offer an independent judgment. The likes of the other organisations that you talk about are think tanks, and they provide their own analysis, and you know that's fine, and we sometimes refer to that. We certainly look at their work, but it's the OBR that we work with as the independent body.
Interesting. So these other organizations, like you say, have their own ideas, their own thoughts, and certainly, like you say, you look at them, but for the public's sake, the body that you're interacting with on a very close basis, and I'm assuming very regularly, particularly in the lead up to a fiscal event like the budget, is the Office for Budget Responsibility.
Correct.
Okay, so you've got the Office for Budget Responsibility. We've heard, again, throughout the news, every week it was almost a different story about how much headroom was not available. So in the lead up to the budget, is the Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, are they in touch with you more regularly than they would normally be, or about the same? And is it almost a weekly update in which you're getting information about what the fiscal headroom looks like?
So they... Just to re-emphasize, they are an arm's length body, and they don't tell us what we can or can't do. Absolutely not. But they do provide analysis, as I say, as to the state of finances and whether or not we're in keeping with our fiscal rules. What they do provide in the run-up to a budget is several rounds of draft iterations, essentially, of forecasts, which then inform our policy-making process, right? So there is definitely an uptick in the communication between the OBR and the Treasury in the run-up to a budget, as you'd expect. And, the content of the forecasts can evolve throughout the process in order to account for new information that comes up through that period. It is definitely something that is a moving feast in the run-up to a budget.
And so you're going through your meetings with them. You're looking, obviously, for things coming forward. Out of interest, when does it get to the point where the brakes are put on, decisions are made? How far in advance of the budget is it normally got to be signed, sealed, and delivered, and then under lock and key?
Essentially, is a question for the Chancellor. But I think the OBR process runs up quite close to the fiscal event itself, just because those forecasts, you know, can change depending on what's going on in the world and what's going on in the country. But I think some measures are decided earlier than others, and you adapt to what the forecasts say as close to the fiscal event as possible.
And so obviously this is a very market sensitive time as well. Information is absolutely critical to not really being leaked, particularly the details, because obviously there would be huge ramifications, as I say, on not just the UK's financial services and markets, but also the world's, to be perfectly frank, as well. There is a rumour about the printing process for a budget. And the rumour is that one civil servant is each given a responsibility for printing a different section of the budget. Is this classic Westminster Whispers where we get all very excited? Or is it really just the Chancellor's very tight team that know every nook and cranny? Are you kind of almost locked out of knowing everything until maybe the night before or even the morning of? Or will that vary from chance to chance about how much detail is given amongst the wider teams, including his ministerial team?
So a budget will involve lots of different people, lots of civil servants in the Treasury working on their particular area of expertise and policy focus. So, the tax team will have a pretty good idea of what's going in. There are certain measures that are particularly sensitive, obviously, that a smaller team will be aware of. Like I said, Treasury ministers are heavily involved in the budget process. So we have our significant part to play in it and know what's going on, particularly in our portfolios. We have a good sense for, but it is ultimately the Chancellor's decision, even though, there are lots of decisions to be made. In terms of the actual printing process, this is not something I'm familiar with in terms of the full detail, but I do know there's a relationship with a printing company and there are various measures, as you'd expect, to ensure that, it's kept under wraps until the moment he arrives at the House of Commons. And
are you popular with all your friends and family who are like, come on, just give us a little bit of taste of what's coming down the track? You get constituents going, local pubs going, out of interest, what's happening on, if alcohol duty were frozen, for example, Minister, like what would that, would that sound about right to you? Like, do you get much of that going on?
I think there's a little bit of that going on, but I think most people realise that, it's for the Chancellor to announce the budget and we're not going to be divulging any secrets in advance.
So there's a lot of trust, obviously, in the Treasury then, because like you say, having very market sensitive and important discussions, there has to be total trust between the politicians and the civil servants in that department, because you will understand that a lot of budget sometimes seems to get briefed in advance, or the details slowly seem to drip feed out. Some might call it kite flying, where people are testing the waters to see what the reaction would be, and others would say, we kind of now got used to the idea of over a 2-3 week period before the budget, essentially already knowing what it's going to be. Now, of course, I'm not accusing anyone or anything, just important. James and I have both been very clear. We don't talk to journalists when we're on this podcast, apart from when we're interviewing them, of course. But essentially, is that a good thing that's happening? Or is that just probably a natural part of politics that essentially in a digital world where information is much more accessible, and obviously we have classic print broadcast, but also now online media forms, it's just a reality that you can't escape, and that the idea to always try and pin it on the government as trying to be sort of deliberately doing it is probably unfair.
I mean, all I would say to this is there was a number of reports I've read at various fiscal events the last year or two where it was definitively going to be this that was announced. And funnily enough, it didn't end up happening because it was not based on very robust information from certainly anybody inside. So no, we have a very robust process here in the Treasury to ensure that, obviously the market sensitive information is well protected and worked on by people who are incredibly passionate and trustworthy and patriotic when it comes to making sure that a budget is a success. And that's been my personal experience through the last couple of budgets.
Now, there's obviously a wider ministerial team, and I'm keen to understand. So we've got the Chancellor, which everyone knows. We've got someone called the Chief Secretary to the Treasury, which in this case is Laura Trott. You're the Exchequer to the Treasury. Out of interest, what do all these different titles actually mean? Because the Treasury just means, I think, to most people, like myself, money. Treasury equals money. Like, what do all these titles mean very specific things? Or again, is that flexible with portfolios? The ministers, can that chop and change depending on?
Yeah, no, it's pretty nailed on. I mean, the odd sort of policy area may change from time to time, but it's a pretty long-standing setup actually, and we found that it actually works pretty well. I found the Treasury to be quite a flat sort of organization. Like I said, you have a lot of scope for policy development and say. I mean, just to give you an explanation, so the Chief Secretary to the Treasury is responsible essentially for spending. So talked earlier about the spending review. They own that process.
I always refer to them as bad cop.
Well,
they're the bad cops. The Charles is good cop.
They play an incredibly important role in making sure that money is not just given to departments to spend, but is that it's spent really well as well. You have the financial secretary, who is essentially the tax minister. So
okay.
They have most of the
Nigel
big
Huddleston,
taxes,
right?
And that's at the moment. Yeah, that's Nigel Huddleston, who is doing a great job and liaises with HMRC and all of the the big taxes he is responsible for overseeing. You have the economic secretary, who is also known as the city minister. And they are responsible for primarily financial services and professional services. That is BIM.
Here we go. Look, I've been paying attention to you
guys.
I'm paying attention to what Treasury's doing.
And, you know, that's a really important role. It's an industry that contributes, you know, certainly over 90 odd billion to our tax coffers, over a million people employed. It's really important role because financial markets drive a lot of what we do in the economy. And it's really important. And then you've got the Exchequer Secretary, which is me. And that role is I'm biased, but I find it really interesting. It's the Minister for Growth and Productivity within the Treasury. Although I like to think every minister in the Treasury is about growth and productivity. but what that means is that I have, you know, sort of day-to-day activity on infrastructure.
Okay.
In particular, and energy. But then also various taxation to do with the environment, to do with energy. I have fuel duty. I have
You're very popular with me on that front, don't you worry.
Thank you. I have alcohol duty. And we've just taken through the House of Commons the biggest reform to alcohol duty in 140 years, very much the baby of the former Chancellor Rishi Sunak when he was here at the Treasury.
Famously a teetotaler.
Famously a teetotaler, but he
I like it though. I like that.
You can talk to officials here and they will tell you he has an amazing, I mean, we know he's got a pretty decent mind on him, but he can tell you a lot about various types of alcohol because he really went into the weeds of, you know, what will the impact be on Scrumpy Jacks, or what will the impact be on this type of lager or that type of cider or this kind of wine. And
brewers like Titanic Brewery, we're randomly based in Burslem and Stoke-on-Trent North, you know, just as an example. Yeah, no, absolutely.
I'm sure you've got some amazing brewers.
Well, I'm a teetotaler like the Chancellor, so I wait for a 0% to come out so I can start enjoying
that.
That's
a good thing for all of us. God knows what you'd be like otherwise.
And then I know we're getting to the end, and obviously I'm mindful of your time because you've been very generous with it. So a couple of final things. Number one is, what's the most egregious example of lobbying by a minister or a department or a colleague in the build-up to a budget that you think you've witnessed, without naming names necessarily?
I do not know what you're talking about. My relationship with other ministerial colleagues in our departments has been absolutely wonderful. They are all strong advocates for their particular department and
who's the cheekiest, Gareth? Come
area.
On.
But it is interesting, you know, former Treasury ministers who are now in departments, you know, I'm told that is a particular dynamic, but they know how it works, right? And they know the Treasury process. And, you know, that's an important thing, that we have a Treasury alumni into spending departments who know the process and they know what we're working with, right? And so I have to say it is a really good working relationship with all of our ministerial.
Does that mean they're the ones who know which how to do the bar charts and the spreadsheets to make them look really attractive to Treasury? Is that an unfair characterization of Treasury officials that it's all spreadsheets and bar charts and everything else that goes with it?
No, look, we're acutely aware that we're spending not our money, but the taxpayers' money. And I think everybody that I work with in government is acutely aware of that. And when we are making decisions about where that money goes, we're always thinking, you know, are we getting the most bang for our buck? Can this translate into more business investment, for example, or better outcomes in public services? That's what drives us every day, because ultimately, you know, there is only so much money and we have to make sure it goes further. That's why we've got this big project being driven by the Chief Secretary on public sector productivity, because that really is the key for making sure that money goes further, but also that we have more available for other things that we want to invest in.
Now, famously on the day of the budget, everyone walks out of 11 Downing Street who is a Treasury minister. You stand in a line, the Chancellor holds up the briefcase, and all the press take their photo, and today is the day. There's also, I think you get to walk, there's a photo on the staircase normally as well. What's that, just briefly, that process
it's
like?
It's a great day. I mean, Budget Day is one of those days in Parliament, no matter who you are, whether you're in the Treasury or you're an MP not related, you know, not involved in the Treasury. It's an occasion, right? It really does feel, I remember our first budget, yep, you and I had after getting elected, the queue outside to get a seat in the chamber.
8 a.m. queue.
Yeah, I think it was even earlier.
You had to get about 6 a.m. for the doors to open at 8 a.m. to get your seat.
That was it. I think it was about 6 a.m. and there was literally seating provided by the doorkeepers just to get a seat. And it's a real occasion. It does make you, you know, feel very privileged to be a member of Parliament and be in the chamber to witness these big events and big decisions that are going to be impacting millions of people. And then, you know, to be in the Treasury and to be in a role where you get to be behind the scenes on the day, that's a really amazing thing, personally, that I'm acutely aware of. And, you know, we have a bit of a gathering just before the sort of famous photo moment.
Yeah.
Have a cup of tea with the Chancellor and then we go out, you know, as you say, line up out on the street in front of this massive bank of photographers, and then make our way over to the House of Commons. There's a real occasion around a budget, and like I say, it's just an amazing thing to be involved in.
Is there anything in the box the Chancellor's holding up?
That is something
I'll have to ask the
Chancellor. You're going to have to ask the Chancellor.
Oh, I have to ask. Now, final question. There was famously a rule where in the House of Commons, the Chancellor on a budget day is allowed to pour themselves an alcoholic beverage to treat themselves whilst they're giving a speech. Now, sadly, this has died out as a tradition, in my opinion. And I think I can't remember who the last person was. I'm pretty sure it was a little bit of whiskey,
It was Ken Clark.
I think it was Ken Clark.
Let me put it this way. Ken Clark told me it was him.
Ken Clark said it was him.
But I think it was Gordon Brown that ended up dropping the tradition. And it hasn't yet been brought back, but you never know.
Well, my last thing, Gareth, is if you were Chancellor, would you have a little beverage of alcohol beside you if you had the chance to do so?
Now, whether I do or not, or did or not, I certainly would need it, I think. It's quite a big thing to be delivering a budget. I don't know how Jeremy does it in such a relaxed way. But I think I do think some of these traditions are quite nice, but I also understand why some of them go away as well.
Well, we're pinning hopes on the fact that you will do that. Look, a big thank you, Gareth, for joining us today, for sharing us what goes on in the build-up and obviously understanding how the Treasury works. Thank you to all the listeners for tuning in to Inside Whitehall. Make sure you press that subscribe button however you listen to us. Make sure you leave us a rating and a review. And of course, you can follow us on X, known as Twitter formerly, @WhitehallPodUK. Thank you, Gareth.